are listening to a Hive Talk Live Stinger. Buzz buzz. Welcome in, Hornets fans, to another Hive Talk Live Stinger here on HiveTalkLive.com. I'm Doug Branson. I am continuing to bug my friends to come into the studio and talk Hornets with me. That continues today with Adi Joseph from SportingNews.com. Adi covers the NBA for Sporting News. He also was around the team a lot last season, wrote some great stuff on Frank Kaminsky, Al Jefferson, and more. We talk a lot about the future of the Hornets in this interview, and I know that's what you are really interested in, but we also recap the season that was. It was an exciting season for Hornets fans as this organization got back to the playoffs and got back on track. It certainly did not end the way a lot of us wanted it to end. There was opportunity to be had for the Hornets in this playoffs, and that's disappointing, obviously, but the future is very bright for this franchise. But there are a lot of question marks here in free agency, and we talk about Al Jefferson, we talk about Nick Batum, we talk about Jeremy Lin. And if you haven't listened to my interview with Adam Chin from BaselineBuzz.com, you should definitely go back and listen to that. We've got a lot more of this type of content coming to you this spring and summer, and we're also going to be doing some fantastic things with video. So buckle in, Hornets talk for the hardcore fan. I know the season is out, but we've got a lot more to come. Thanks for listening. Without further ado, let's get to Adi Joseph from SportingNews.com.
Very few teams can simply point to their weaknesses and then fix them. It's a huge credit to Rich and Steve and Michael Jordan and the organization as a whole. A lot of times it requires a coaching change, and that's another thing. You know, a lot of teams have pointed to weaknesses and said, okay, we'll hire a coach. Well, we saw what happened when the Pelicans and Bulls did that this year.
And Memphis seems to be doing that with Jaeger.
Right. Now Memphis is doing that with Jaeger, and we'll see if they – I would not be surprised at all if they do exactly what the Pelicans and Bulls did and they take a big step backward because they're trying to change. The Pacers might do the same. You know, for the Hornets to do it without a coaching change, without changing their best player, like adding a star, that was pretty remarkable and rare.
And I think what some people may not realize is that and I saw this in a couple of articles talking about the team's transformation and this idea that, you know, Steve Clifford has changed the way that he coaches basketball to include all of this three-point shooting, but that's not necessarily the case. If you look at his history as an assistant coach, it was based in this four-out, one-in offense, whether it was in Orlando or Houston or Los Angeles, or maybe not so much Los Angeles, but he's been there before, and I think he people underestimate his willingness to accept this new three-point shooting system that we're all living under now.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Van Gundys, both Van Gundy brothers and all of their assistants have a reputation for being defensive-minded and anti-analytics, which is bogus in a lot of ways. I mean, just watch Stan Van Gundy's teams. The guy, I mean, sliding Rashard Lewis to the floor was a major moment in the NBA and succeeding and making the finals with that lineup. It basically said, if you have the right center, you don't need a power forward. And we'll look around. It bared out over the next 7 years. So Stan had a big role. A lot of people would give him credit, and Steve was an assistant on that team. The Rockets, while under Jeff Van Gundy, maybe they weren't playing Maury ball like they do now, but they were a very fluid, modern team. You know, they had a lot of skilled players surrounding Yao, and they based their offense on get the ball in and then pop it back out. And that was, you know, a huge part of what they did. So we've seen Steve Clifford surrounded by several very brilliant coaches. We've seen him adapt to various things. And this isn't new. Like you said, the turnover thing is the number one tenet of Steve Clifford's philosophy is don't turn the ball over, without a doubt. and his teams always are amazing at not turning the ball over. Eric Spoelstra sounded like he was going crazy trying to turn the Hornets over because they, for some reason, entered the series thinking, if we can force a few extra turnovers, we'll win this series easily. And realized, you know, the Hornets were turning the ball over like 8 times a game in that series. So that's just what Steve Clifford does. His teams are always good at not turning the ball over, playing smart. The biggest difference here was just that they made their shots.
When you look back at all of the offseason moves in respect to style and strategy, from acquiring Spencer Hawes, Jeremy Lamb, Jeremy Lin, drafting Frank Kaminsky, letting, not only bringing guys in, but letting guys like Bismack Biyombo walk, is there one move to you that really stands out and says, yes, they were trying to modernize this team?
Sliding Cody DeZeller to center is probably the most underrated move of the season. Mm-hmm. I actually think the only acquisition that was a bigger deal was Batum. And in terms of how they played, in terms of the structure of how they played. Like, Jeremy Lin had a very big impact, but ultimately he was playing a role that made sense in any lineup. Sliding Cody to center was the move that signified their shift. And that was because Cody wasn't working as a power forward. They wanted him to shoot, but he had a shoulder injury all offseason. Couldn't really work on his shot. Never got his three-pointer in a place that he could rely on it. And they wanted to shift four out. They make Cody a center, and essentially all he starts doing is just setting screens and throwing his body around and running at the rim. And it was extremely effective. I mean, obviously he's not the rim runner that DeAndre Jordan is, but he kind of made his living off of those little flip passes to him, and when he needed to score, he would like throw up a crazy looking layup and probably fall to the ground afterward. And
or getting running head start and dunk the ball.
Yeah. And Cody is athletic enough to do that, and he's very fast actually. And that move and taking him and Al off the court at the same time is what opened up the floor. Adding Spencer Hawes and Frank Kaminsky alongside Marvin Williams as the power forwards, or the guys who play with Cody and Al, was a big part of that because they can all shoot. And that's ultimately, I think, what opened up the floor and set up the four-out system.
And it's interesting because you just said, you know, that Stan Van Gundy ran this system in Orlando with Steve Clifford that said, you know, if you have the right center, you don't need a power forward. It's kind of the opposite that happened in Charlotte this season because they had Marvin Williams, who had a career year at power forward, and he seemed to be the exact right power forward for that situation, and it allowed Cody Zeller to learn the center job sort of on the job and get adjusted to that new role and eventually somewhat thrive in that new role. But Marvin's ascension certainly had a big effect on the way they approached their style and strategy for this season. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I think one of the questions of this offseason is Cody Zeller the right center? Mm-hmm. And I asked Rich Cho directly, do you think that Cody Zeller is your starting center for next season? You know, he mentioned he wanted a rim protector, and he was kind of vague on what that meant. So my thought was an upgrade on Cody would make a lot of sense for this team. You know, if they could get Hassan Whiteside or Dwight Howard for the right price, if they could even get Ian Mahinmi or, at a really low price, Roy Hibbert, maybe coming off the bench. But they were pretty steadfast. Cody Zeller's the right center. And an offseason where Zeller can actually prepare to be a center could do him really well. They're still working on his shooting, yes, but I would think that they're going to try to teach him ways to be a better rim protector. I would assume that that's a part of the strategy if they still see him as the starting center of the future, because Cody doesn't have a lot of experience in that role. So the real step now, to me, I mean, if I'm looking at the roster and they can bring back everyone, I still say they're not quite where they would like to be at center. And we saw that when Whiteside dominated them. And that's the next step for Cody. But Marvin having a career year both in rebounding and shot blocking was absolutely enormous to what worked last season.
And you know what's interesting with Cody Zeller? I listened to the exit interviews from both Zeller and Clifford, and not that they're not on the same page about where the development needs to be, but it seems the focus is different. With when you ask Cody, he seems to be interested in adding strength and bulk, and then when you ask Clifford, he still seems to be focused on Cody Zeller adding a three-point shot, something that I think that Cody has been a little hot and cold on, whether or not he needed that shot to be successful in the NBA. And I just wonder, just moving forward, them not really being completely in line on what that development needs to be this offseason will affect whether or not they go out and get somebody.
Right. And I actually, I believe it was Russell Varner who wrote an article on at the Hive. Actually, no, it wasn't Russell. I don't remember who it was. Someone wrote an article on At the Hive about Cody basically being portrayed as a stretch four mostly because he's white, which is funny and probably partially true because that's kind of been in his scouting reports since he was at Indiana, even though, you know, his biggest thing is his athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
He's not particularly skilled. We've seen that where he's too far into his NBA career for anyone to mistake him for Spencer Hawes.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to agree with Cody. I think that they might be making a mistake here by continually trying to make Cody into a stretch player, potentially a five out player. I think when I look at his,
but I think it goes back to what you said, that I think it reflects not only a different vision for how the player should develop, but a different vision on what they think the player can be. Because I think if you're Cody and you think, if I'm going to be a center, a starting center, then I've got to add strength so that I can go up against other starting centers. But if you believe that Cody is going to be cannot really be an impact player as a starting center and would probably be best served coming off the bench, then you think, okay, he's got to add a three-point shot.
Well, but again, I asked Rich, they see him as a starting center. And, you know, to me, Cody Zeller is still in a position in his life. He's young enough. Keep in mind, he's the same high school graduating class as Kaminsky. He's young enough. He's got the right body type and the right athleticism level. I personally would rather see him develop into Andrew Bogut. And that kind of player, a player who does what Bogut does for the Warriors, which is sets hard screens all the time.
Which he did in the playoffs.
And then rolls to the basket and very occasionally will actually, you know, they'll actually maybe run a play for him, but almost never. I think that Cody could thrive in that kind of role if he learns, number one, rim protection techniques, because he certainly has the athleticism. Let's keep in mind this guy has like a 38-inch vertical. And better understands how – well, you have to be stronger to set better screens, and you have to learn how to roll at the highest level, and I don't think he quite has that yet. So there's a – I mean, I certainly am not portraying myself as knowing more about basketball than Clifford or Cho, but I sort of disagree with their vision. If they believe Cody Zeller is the starting center, having him focus on three-point shooting instead of focusing on what the modern center does – in a four-out offense where the center is the one in, to me could potentially, you know, lead to a, I don't want to say a wasted offseason, but if the guy can't shoot 35% on threes, then you don't really want him taking threes. If he can be that great pick-and-roll center, that could have huge value to a team that has three shooters surrounding the perimeter along with the pick-and-roll pair.
Let's move on to Al Jefferson, because when and how they could utilize him at the center position dictated a lot of the team's style and strategy this season. He probably had the most eventful year of any Charlotte Hornets player. There was obviously the weight loss storyline before the season, injuries to his calf, suspensions, constantly changing role on the team. Let's start at the beginning of the year. Al Jefferson seemed to understand the team was moving away from his style of play somewhat, did they not? He seemed to have an understanding of
that.
Yeah.
Before the season, I had a 20-minute talk with Al about the future of the NBA and the future of him and just everything about basketball. And He understood where they were going. He understood where he understands where the NBA is going. He doesn't like it necessarily, but which you can understand. But Al clearly showed he has some value. You know, in that series against the Heat, he was huge against Whiteside because Whiteside doesn't really know how to defend a guy like that. The flip side is I tend to think that Al's future is coming off the bench for any team he ends up on. I do not really think that any team would be smart to start Al Jefferson. I think his best role is going to be as your number one scorer off the bench, and he did that really well for most of the season for the Hornets. And I would be surprised if they were even – as I said, Rich Cho gave a definitive yes, I see Cody Zeller as a starting center, which means – if we bring back Al, we don't see him as a starting center.
Mm-hmm.
So Al knows that, I'm sure, or at least he heard that and maybe was a little surprised. But that's the reality for Al. He's a great post-up center, which can have a lot of value off the bench. It does not it will clog things up when you have your other four most talented players on the court with him. And that's the reason, essentially, that you don't want him as your starting center is because he'll actually do better when he's surrounded by less talented players because he can be the focal point of the offense.
He came back after the All-Star break after, again, injuring his calf and then being suspended and coming back briefly and getting re-injured. But he came back after the All-Star break to that bench role. Were you surprised at how easily he transitioned to the bench after starting most of his prime career?
Not really. Again, the other factor, along with the fact that he was not on the court with as many talented players, you know, not being on the court consistently with Kemba, Batum, and Marvin, and Courtney Lee, meant that there were more shots available for him. But on top of that, he fits the bill of what a post-up bench player can do, which earlier this season, Seth Partnow from
Nylon Calculus
wrote a pretty good article. Actually, it was for the Washington Post. He wrote a very good article about the impact of low post scoring off the bench and against second units. Second units just don't have anyone who can defend. Most second units, it's sort of the Heat were sort of the opposite because the Heat started Whiteside and late in the series were bringing Haslam off the bench, and Haslam's a much better post defender than Whiteside. But most teams have a really good defensive center as their starter. Most teams focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're playing the Warriors and you've got Bogut starting and Spates off the bench. And if you're Al, who are you going to score easily against? Well, Spates. You know, for most teams, a low post center is going to be more effective because off the bench because they're facing second units that just don't have the size or the ability to match up against them. And so, again, I really just believe I believe Al can be a very effective player for another 3 or 4 years at least, but I think it's going to be off the bench.
I think the problem is that off the bench, other teams can counter with faster, quicker pick and roll schemes and get smaller and exploit some of his weaknesses on the defensive end. I think that's what Miami...
That happens in the starting lineups too.
Yeah. I just think it's easier to mismatch on the defensive end from a second unit perspective than with your first unit. You're pretty locked into that, at least in the regular season. And then, you know, all bets are off in the playoffs. But it will be interesting to see how that develops. And before the season started, Al Jefferson said, and this was in an article that you wrote for the Sporting News, or for Sporting News, excuse me, "I think people don't realize three-point shooting is what makes me who I am. And to me, that was never more apparent than in that first round series versus Miami, because Miami did everything they could to shut down the 3-point shooting, and it put the focus on Al Jefferson. It's kind of funny because when I take a look at that quote, I think people don't realize 3-point shooting is what makes me who I am. I think, and probably what the spirit behind that was that if the team is better at shooting the three, then it opens up things for me. But in the playoffs, it was kind of the opposite. The team struggled to shoot three-pointers specifically because Miami did things to take that away, and it opened up things for Al Jefferson.
It's funny because these players are being, you know, sort of exercised from the NBA slowly, but you can't single cover Zach Randolph. You can't single cover Al Jefferson. You can't single cover DeMarcus Cousins in the post. You can't do it. Maybe there are maybe five players in the league who can handle them one-on-one. But we saw with Whiteside, the third place finisher and defensive player of the year, the best shot blocker in the league by a wide margin. He could not cover Al Jefferson in the post. That's the Heat were really, really hoping that Hassan Whiteside, being a much bigger, more athletic, younger, better player than Al, that he can handle him and we'll stick to our men on and not get burned on threes. And instead, Al just cooked and pump faked his way around Whiteside, fouled him out in game six. That was the most important game in the series by far.
Yeah.
But, yes, they lost, but they had a huge comeback largely because Al kept basically taking Whiteside off the court. And that's where Al is going to continue to be valuable for whatever team he ends up on. I don't know if he's going to be willing to take the kind of price cut that the Hornets want.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate in that series that I think you saw some of the endurance issues that he had because of some of the injuries that set back his season time and time again. And I think some people commented that Hassan Whiteside had started to figure out Al Jefferson by the end of that series and at least not send him to the free throw line as often, maybe not necessarily stop his offense, but stop him from affecting the game so much. But really, I looked at it and saw a guy who just couldn't stay on the floor long enough and long enough stretches. So.
Right.
But he did have an impact on the series. I want to talk about MKG briefly as well, because the seven games that he returned gave a much different picture, a window into a much different team than we saw for most of the other, this is going to test my math here, 75 games of the season, and definitely in the playoffs as well. But when you look back at those seven games, what does it tell you about how the Hornets will try to re-implement him into this team?
Well, first of all, I want to say it was kind of sad that almost all those games were on the road, if not all those games. It was like during a road stretch that he came back, West Coast swing. So I didn't get a chance. I think I saw him play in person once this year, which was not what I was hoping, because I love Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. And I will say another thing I disagree with Rich Cho and Steve Clifford about is I think that he has more, and I think he showed it. I think he has more offensive potential than they give him credit for, at least publicly. They have been very clear that they don't ever see him being a major impact player offensively, which is interesting. That I don't believe he's a go-to scorer. But what we saw when he was on the court was he was leading the pick and roll. He was the ball handler. With Batum and Kemba on the court, they were running the wings, and MKG was running the offense on numerous possessions, particularly in that game against the Lakers. I still remember it well because it was exciting, and it gave you a glimpse of, wow, this guy's back, and this team is so much better with him. He's not only the toughest player on the team, not only the best defender on the team, but he has great court vision and ball handling skills that make up for his lack of shooting. And that allows him, four out is kind of a misnomer. It doesn't mean you necessarily have four players who can shoot. It means you're in the NBA, in the modern NBA, you're probably running a pick and roll of some sort. Those two players don't count. The other three players have to shoot. So when MKG and Cody Zeller were running a pick and roll, it was important that the other three players be able to hit their threes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a bonus if it's MKG and Frank Kaminsky running that pick and roll and Kaminsky pops out for a three. But and that's where they could be going with Cody, is they want him to be not only a pick and roll player, but a pick and pop player. MKG has the potential to be that lead ball handler in a lot of situations. Not full time, because Kemba's still going to do it full, like Kemba's still going to be the number one ball handler, but we saw the potential that MKG has, the feel for the game, the passing ability and the ball handling ability to run that pick and roll and be a much more effective offensive player than we've ever seen him.
Well, and the thing is, what defenders were starting to understand, and I think they would have fully understood had MKG been able to stay on the floor, is that you can't sag too far off of him, because if you give him a running head start towards the rim, he's normally going to finish that.
Because he's so athletic.
He's extremely athletic, and he was In several instances, he was an off-ball roll man. He was able to do something that even Nick Batum couldn't, which is roll with Kemba in either a pick-and-roll situation or just Kemba taking his man one-on-one. And Kemba found him on numerous occasions.
And the scary thing that he showed a full knack for even the past 2 years before this one is that guy will find the crack in your defense, make you forget he exists, and just like Nightcrawler, just appear at the rim and either grab an offensive rebound for a putback or get a alley-oop thrown to him or a bounce pass in the through the middle of the lane and you didn't even see him. And the next thing you know, he's got a dunk or a layup. And he showed that ability. That was kind of how he got seemingly almost all his points when he was healthy 2 years ago. This season, he added that ball handling ability, that confidence to lead the pick and roll. And if he ever adds a jump shot, I mean, I don't believe he can be as good offensively as Kawhi Leonard, which is not, that'd be crazy. But I believe he could be he reminds me, his developmental pattern reminds me quite a bit of Kawhi, except with horrible injuries getting in the way. Yeah. And, so that's obviously going to delay him. Having shoulder injuries probably means on top of the fact that he just was never naturally a good shooter, he probably will never develop into the shooter that Kawhi has certainly developed into. But other elements of his game are similar, and Kawhi has that same innate ability to just find the hole in the defense. And, MKG, I don't want to get too hyped about seven games, but those were seven of the best games the Hornets played.
Well, I think there could be a great article written about the distinction between a great shooter and a great shot maker. Because I think MKG will... I agree with you. I don't think he'll ever be the shooter that Kawhi has developed into. But he was starting to show in those seven games this ability to back down his guy one-on-one and hit a turnaround jumper. And if you can pair the turnaround jumper with the slashing, with the occasional three, then you can get to 15 to 20 a night and be an elite shot maker.
Right.
And that's what the Hornets could use. So, yeah, I think the great thing about MKG is what made that Miami team great in that first round series is that it's versatility. It's being able to plug him in into any situation and make it work because he's a smart enough player to know, I'm playing with A, B, C, D. What does my game need to be right now? Yeah. And so it will be very interesting to see him play. Now let's shift gears.
I want to add one thing. I genuinely believe, and I'll say it on the air, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is the best player on the Hornets.
I think that if you watch those seven games closely and if you've paid attention to his development, that would be hard to argue against. And that says a lot because we saw the leap that Kemba Walker made this year, and we'll talk more in depth about with Nata Edwards, but we saw the leap that Kemba made, and yet still, when you go back and watch those seven games, he's just so incredibly dynamic, and he's always the most energetic person on the court offensively or defensively, and he is a difference maker if he can stay on the court, and that will be one of the biggest question marks heading into 2016-17. Let's reflect now that we are done with the season. That's what this whole show is about, season wrap. We're reflecting. The Hornets are going to reflect. They're going to try to refine what they did this season and make it, try to either replicate it or make it somewhat better. What do you think they will look to acquire based on the shortcomings that they had to end this year? Do you think they'll change the strategy at all, the approach?
I think they're going to have a bit of a wake-up call when they go and pay Nick Batum, which they almost certainly will do, and then realize that Marvin Williams is getting a lot more than they realized. Jeremy Lin's going to get a lot more than they realized. And they're going to have to make some changes. And I believe that they're not going to have the option to not make those changes because there's a $1 billion to be spent in the NBA this offseason. And a player like Marvin Williams has immense value to every team in this league. And while I'm not specifically saying Marvin's gone, I'm going to say they're going to lose more than I think people would like to see them lose, and I don't think Batum will be one of those pieces. So the big thing I would say they need to find is they need to replace whoever goes, because if it is Marvin, that's he's not an easy person to replace. Mm-hmm. They need to make a decision if MKG could be a power forward full time, but if Marvin goes. But the other thing that they need to do for sure is get some toughness, get some strength, and that could be Cody adding some strength and some bulk. It could be Kaminsky adding some strength and some bulk, but clearly they got embarrassed in Game 7.
Yeah, I think that was what I was going to ask is I think if you look back on this past offseason and you evaluate it based on the performances in the regular season and in the playoffs, you have to look at it and go, okay, they added a ton of skill, a ton of shooting, which are two things that this team has not had in many years, but they weren't able to acquire physicality, toughness, and maybe versatility, sort of two-way play.
One of the interesting things about that is that they still had a great defensive rebound percentage in the regular season, one of the best in the league. So they're still mostly doing their job boxing out. But what we saw was in the playoffs, everyone gets more physical, mm-hmm. and you can't afford to be a soft team.
So do you think in the offseason they'll look to create... Because it seemed like they created a really great regular season team last season. Do you think that they'll take these lessons and...
One to two players. That's all they have to do.
Yeah.
You know, even honestly, I couldn't believe that they didn't turn to Tyler Hansbrough earlier in Game 7 in particular. I mean, that guy's just a wrecking ball. Nothing else. They had him on the bench. They didn't really use him. I don't think he'll be back because he didn't play very much. But they're going to have to find... one player at least, and it very well could be Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who helps them up their edge for the playoff mentality. And then on top of that, like you said, Lynn's probably gone, and they're probably going to have to replace him, and it's not going to be easy to find a player who can play both point guard and shooting guard in an offseason where there's just no free agent point guards. So that's going to be a challenge. It's going to be really – it's a potential step back year. They won 48 games this year, but a lot of players had career seasons. Even if they bring everyone back, 48 wins is really good. And, you know, I'm optimistic about the fact that MKG's returning, but who knows how long he'll play. This is not necessarily, you know, an easy season to replicate. And I don't think that Hornets fans should get the sense that, okay, next season we got to win 55 games or it's not a success.